The Shaggy Jenkins Show.
We have to make Russia great again.
On the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome to it. Boy, today do we have a lot to cover in our news of the week, including Notre Dame, William Barr, White Power, Flint's Water, Buttigieg, and more. But before we get to all of that, well, some brief introductions are in line. First off, I'd like to say hello and welcome to the program. I'm, of course, Shaggy Jenkins, your host, critical thinker, problem solver, guy just left of normal and sane, and always centered in common sense, found at my website, shaggyjenkins.com, or wherever fine social media is served, at Shaggy Live. My correspondent today comes from the wonderful Windy City, which sometime at the beginning of this week, I should say, was proposed as a whole separate territory thanks to one crazy GOP member. I give to you from the free and independent nation of Chicago, Chris Bass.
You have overcome, for I am here. Look, we are Chicago strong. I'm pro my city, despite what some lunatic says.
I just want to throw out there how crazy of an idea is it that they were wanting to cut Chicago off from Illinois. I mean, literally, the GDP would drop by a third.
Well, you know, I mean, some people just need more medication than others. They really do.
You know, coming from a legal marijuana state, you know, medical marijuana state, I'm wondering if they're on our medication.
Well, you know, some people, we know when you start taking marijuana, I mean, you know, they start to hallucinate, get the munchies and things like that. And some people just turn mean. So they need some more hardcore medication. I mean, so I wouldn't recommend the nice gateway drug of smoking a pot, but probably something a little more stronger.
Yeah. Morphine, perhaps.
Yeah, there you go.
Let's start off of kind of a somber story and one that has a lot of historical precedence all around the world. Now, it doesn't matter if you're somebody that is not of faith, hi, or you're somebody that is deeply of faith, hello you. A lot of people have ties to the very historical landmark known as the Crown of Thorns that sits atop Notre Dame. And this week we saw a catastrophic fire in what was deemed the forest of the upper level of Notre Dame. Now, Chris, let's talk about this as far as an impactful story. What exactly did we lose with this fire?
I think we lost, obviously we lost history. And first of all, before I begin, my hearts and prayers go out to the people there in Paris to witness that. And to have it gone, it has to be beyond devastating. And once again, taking the faith out of it for a couple of seconds here, the fact that if you're born and raised in that area of Paris, and every day, whether you're going to school or going to work or passing by or driving or walking, that is an iconic monument. It was there for 850 years. I can't wrap my mind around that. You know, and when you're able to be a part of that, I mean, it's in your DNA. Notre Dame Cathedral was in people's DNAs. And then when you see it destroyed, not only are you crying, and it was great coverage from the media to see this impact, but the fact that I think a lot of people, when you see that, you start to question your own mortality. When that's burning down, it's like, how long do I have? You know, I think it's a question of faith at times, obviously, also a question of mortality. And the fact that what you now know is now destroyed. And I think that when you come to the realization about that, it just shows you the great humanity in people. Like the coverage I was watching, they showed obviously people crying and taking out the cell phone devices and recording it. And this time people started to sing. So again, tragedy impact affects people differently. And to see that go around that area when they're recording and for the media, I thought was stellar. But just cameras roll with no commentary in the outlets I watched, and it was just your heart fell for them, obviously. And the fact that they were able to relay it, well, it's kind of like a death where somebody passes away. Now you've seen this iconic church destroyed, it is like a passing of someone dying. So how do you internalize that? How do you deal with that? You cry, you react. And if people reacted differently when they, you know, scope and scan the camera around these various people, I thought was very commendable. And got a chance to see, you know, humans reacting to something compassionately. And on the flip side, they're receiving so much monies, you know, a lot of euros and, you know, people donating, you know, $5 million here and there from America. So President Macron said that with all the monies that have been coming in, you know, just in the past few days, they'll be able to reconstruct Notre Dame in 5 years.
Whoa. And see, here's the thing. Because Notre Dame was built so long ago, that reconstruction can kind of take some weird twists and turns. Chris, I didn't realize this, but the reason that the fire in the forest, and by the way, we should clarify why the top part of Notre Dame was called the forest. The beams themselves were so large, they were so massive, and it didn't have fire breaks, which is, you know, structural support centers throughout the building that could have, one, stopped the fire itself, and two, required a bit different usage of wood. But the forest is literally each of the large, big beams within the top of Notre Dame was a separate tree. And because of the hundreds of them that comprised the top level of Notre Dame, it was referred to literally as a forest. Now, Chris, is it any surprise to you that because the timber is so old, that even now, after all is said and done, French fire marshals have stationed 2 full-time people just to watch the conditions of the attic, because they say the embers and stuff are so old that even with all of the water that was already put on the scene, even with days and days and days of sitting dormant, it could re-spark. Isn't that crazy?
Well, it makes sense. I mean, like you said, you know, we just talked about how old it is. Again, 850 years old of a monument. And of course, you know, not being constructed in an era where, you know, you probably have more, obviously, some modern takes on the whole building. You have to think about when it was built, how it was built, and what could be the aftermath afterwards of the situation. So, yes, that makes sense to have people on guard in case it restructs and reignites. And because the wood is so old, like you said, and just, again, you know, all that age and time versus current times. So you have to, you know, I'm no expert in this situation, but just what I've read, anything can happen, literally, because throughout the whole structure, you may, again, have a reignite or some sort of a shaking of the building, a foundation, because of what happened with all that fire impact.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing is that because it is such an old historical landmark, the restoration of it could take kind of a weird turn when it comes to actually preparing for the next disaster. Now, of course, if you go by modern French building codes, once the forest, which of course it won't be a forest this time, but once the upper level is restored, it will have to have modern structural safeguards against fire spreading like this in the form of something called fire breaks, which is compartments that are required by every major building code in France that would stop fire from spreading too quickly, especially when it comes to big wooden structures. The second thing is that the fire prevention system, the modern fire prevention systems that we associate with every building and structure that we know of its Notre Dame size, they're very wary of putting modern equipment within these old ancient buildings. Now, this is something that is absolutely fascinating because I didn't know this. The fire that destroyed the cathedral this week could have actually been started way sooner because they were trying to prevent fires. Chris, did you know that?
No, I didn't know about that. No.
Well, it seems that when it comes to being able to modernize structures like something built, I don't know, 800 plus years ago, getting modern wiring into a place like that for actual monitoring of smoke and fire and carbon monoxide detectors, the operation of valves for security systems that would either do CO2 disbursement or water disbursement for fire retardation. That is an actual term, by the way. The thing is all of those modern systems, to modernize these old structures like the cathedral was, is actually more of a fire hazard than just letting it remain in its current unsafe state. So this could be a problem after the restoration that one day, one generation, might have to deal with again.
Yeah, we have forward thinking like that, Shaggy. That does make sense. I think the best thing to do, like you just said, about the restoration and things of that nature, you know, just be prepared for the future. And you have to do your best to make sure that this doesn't happen again. But if it does, God forbid, that it wouldn't be that much of a fire compared to this one. Maybe it could be controlled better. Maybe it'll be a lower compared to that if it happens again. But it should be taken into consideration that you probably have to think more of the future for the building. You probably have to do some more modern things to prevent that from happening. You have to do some more modern techniques to implement. So you might have to make some really radical changes of the cathedral just for it to continue to stay erect.
Now, this is the thing. This fire that everybody is talking about, which is, once again, very, very historically important for the entire world, including Paris in particular. I do not want to diminish the absolute tragedy that was this fire. But, Chris, this is a fascinating thing about the story this week. We have one church burning in, and I'm just going to be as literal as possible here. We have one church burning in a country far, far away from the United States that is getting massive amounts of television coverage, yet we've had three fires across the South in historical black congressional denominational churches, and we've also had two hate crimes, one of them perpetrated, and we'll talk about this one in a little bit, against a very historical site for the civil rights movement. Those stories happened this week. And I kind of got to ask, what gives, man? Why aren't we talking about them as much as we're talking about Notre Dame?
Well, going back to the lab, quote unquote, or to the editor's office, or editor's room, when it comes to certain media outlets, it's deemed what's more important. The first thing I learned getting into a news talk was I was told from the newsroom, if it bleeds, it leads. Which is a very somber comment, but it happens to be true. The more horrific the story is, the more attention it gets. So when we look at what happened in France with Notre Dame Cathedral coming, you know, down and burning, that takes precedence over fires and churches that are here in America. And again, it goes back to the editor's desk, he or she or group, what they feel deemed could be there as a lead story. So we got that already from the standpoint of Notre Dame. And those stories really take a back seat, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, because this week, I guess you could say, the big story in America had nothing to do with fires other than political ones. And these fires, unfortunately, Chris, have had a little bit of a smoldering context under other presidential administrations in the past. I refer to, of course, the curious case this week of William Barr, Attorney General's behavior. Walk me through exactly, because I do have to kind of preface this. For some time zones that this show is heard in, you will probably be after the 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time release of William Barr's press conference, okay? The one that he's going to do ahead of the 11 a.m. release of the redacted Mueller report to the House and Senate, and there might be a presidential press conference somewhere around the 10 a.m. mark, depending on if he feels William Barr has done a good enough job. But for those people that listen to the show after that, please understand this show is recorded before William Barr's press conference. So we have to give some context to our time, as this is one of those stories that will be rolling out throughout the day. Now, with that said, interesting facts this week about William Barr. Chris, he's actually tried to use his Department of Justice ties and his position within the Department of Justice two times in the past to kind of manipulate public policy away from presidents that he supported their agenda. Are we surprised that the Attorney General, ahead of the release of the report to the people that should actually be the ones that discern it and disseminate it to us, is it weird to you that Barr is going to have a press conference ahead of the Mueller release?
It should be weird, but look at the days that we have right now with this current administration. Weird is the new norm. Going out of traditional succinctive things is a new norm. To go off a teleprompter is now the new norm. So if all these new norms are going on at one time, it would make some sort of weird sense that Attorney General William Barr would have these press conferences ahead of the Mueller report, and also the fact that one of the cases he has experience in, going back to the 1980s Iran-Contra scandal. Back then, he was able to be a part of the prosecution. One of the quotes that he said back in December of 1992, people in the Iran-Contra affair have been treated very unfairly. And he goes on to pretty much manipulate the whole thing, where the people who were charged with Iran-Contra were released that year on Christmas Eve. Because someone has to be the bad guy or the front person in all this. And, you know, with his situation and experience in cover-ups, you got the right person. Yeah. You got the right person involved. Experience does count for something. So this is not his first time to the rodeo. Game. He knows how this operates. So you get the right person to go in there to spin it and make sure it benefits the presidency.
Yeah, because this is the thing about presidential benefits here. As far as William Barr is concerned, if you're president, you have the benefit of every doubt ever made. And when it comes to his four-page summary, a lot of people said, you know, looking back at this, this is kind of strangely reminiscent, one, of the Iran-Contra scandal, and two, of the sovereign invasion and arrest of Grenada's leader. You probably don't remember this, but a long time back, William Barr kind of wrote an opinion that stated, hey, look, if the United States wants to, without securing the permission of the foreign government, we can go on foreign soil and arrest people that we consider committed crimes against the United States. Now, that's a huge diplomatic no-no, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But again, if you're allowed to manipulate and nobody says anything about your manipulation, you're going to get away with it. There's nobody to view the code to answer to or to be accountable for your actions. You just do it. You know, sometimes things are done in plain sight. Why? Because nobody's paying attention to it.
Yeah. And I mean, in this case, William Barr seems to be singing that nice popular song of the 1980s, Break My Stride, where he's going, ain't nobody going to break my stride. Ain't nobody going to slow me down. Whoa, I got to keep on moving. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what happens when a Caucasian man reads lyric.
Well, let me join you in that as I wouldn't say Caucasian on my end, you know, but a very brown man. And not only break my stride, I remember the singer said break a mine. So he created his own language. Now, that's going to break my stride. Mm. So not only are you, you know, you got confidence what you're doing, you could have your stride going because ain't nobody going to break a it.
Yeah, because the only thing that's going to break a at this conference later on from William Barr seems to be, and this is the part of the story that really kind of disturbs me. It seems allegedly that some of the inner details of the Mueller report did in fact make it to the White House ahead of William Barr's press conference. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a serious, serious, questionable thing to happen when the Department of Justice gives the presidential executive office prior approval of a report before it is released as subpoenaed by Congress. Once again, Congress, Article 1, President, somewhere later on in the document.
Chris, with all the ridiculousness of what William Barr's past behavior has been, with saying that we can do things that we absolutely cannot do, and with using broad decisions to, yeah, that Iran-Contra thing. By the way, we subpoenaed some 1,700 pages of documents some 4 years later and discovered that his summary was absolutely misleading. And a lot of people are saying, wait a minute, if that happened before, how likely is, one, the four-page summary, and two, the press conference to be misleading, Chris?
It's misleading before it even starts. People are creatures of habit. We do things over and over again because that's our routine. And the same could be said of William Barr being Attorney General. Creatures of habit. He has the experience. He has the cachet because he's been here before. So you're already got to question his motives before he hits the microphones, before he gets in front of the press, because of his background. He didn't know anything about William Barr. He just walks up there and get the message as is, not knowing his backstory. But if you do, okay, hold on to your seat, boys and girls. It's going to be a bumpy ride. Mm-hmm. And he'll prove that when he does the press conferences. Why? Because, again, when you're able to take that report and give it to the president is his own editor, is his own delete system, is his own redactor. Why? Because look at the history the president has going back to, say, between him and President Vladimir Putin, when he wanted the translator to leave the room. So you're able to have a free and clear conscience of thought without anybody, you know, looking at you sideways and getting everything is documented. So he's used to being the president, finding a way to get certain information out of a certain situation where if it's not printed or it's not on paper, you can't prove it.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm looking over, and this is kind of one of those things. I am looking over the president's Twitter account, and this is one of the things that a lot of people don't understand. When it comes to the Mueller report, a lot of the president's behavior has been on public display and archived in the Library of Congress because their tweets, they are public record. And as public record, a lot of people have speculated and a lot of kind of inside sources to various media people have leaked out that there is definitely a lot in the president's Twitter account to kind of dissect, especially when it comes to things like obstruction and misdirection and, you know, all the bad stuff. Well, this is the thing. He put out a story yesterday, hashtag Brett Bart News is what he said, that the media failed to, quote, gaslight the public about Trump's campaign spying. William Barr started this whole debate about we spied on the president during his campaign. And now conspiratorial conservative media is running. Can we expect this to be Donald Trump's kind of in-between reaction between Barr and the House getting the report?
Well, of course it is. I mean, again, when you have a foot soldier like Barr who's going to go in there and do this dirty work for the president and make sure the president, quote unquote, looks good in the eyes of the public, in the eyes of the citizens, he's going to do his job, continue to spin the narrative. And that's why he's there for. So he'll do a fantastic job in the eyes of Trump. Trump will come on and give him all the praise in the world, just like he did WikiLeaks, unless he forgets. But other than that, you know, he'll go on there and just, you know, it's like a, you know how you go to a concert and before you see the main act, you see all these other acts in front of it? This is what's going on. So the main act, obviously, is Trump, but Barr is the act before. This is what you're going to get before the main attraction.
Yeah. So he is basically the flea to the rest of the circus. And when it comes to this story, it is definitely circus-like. One of the things, though, that I want to say before we get to a break here, because we got about 2 minutes before break, is that Barr has this pattern, time and time and time again, of defending conservative things to the point of, if not illegality, at least questionable behavior and questionable legitimacy, shall we say. Not legality so much as legitimacy. Chris, when the Department of Justice and the Attorney General are trying to spin something that one of its own members, Rob Rosenstein, authorized to happen. When they're trying to spin a special prosecutor's report, how bad can we expect things politically to get from here?
Well, we're already there, as far as I'm concerned. You know, but there used to be sometimes a policy of both sides of the aisle every now and again coming together, the olive branch, and have bipartisanship. Now it's divide and conquer on both sides. It's, we don't want to hear your side. We don't need to hear your side. It's an all-out, flat-out war. And sometimes, you know, when you have war, you do have casualties. And the casualties are the American people in between. And we have seen now both sides digging into what they believe in. And I'm all for that. But for the sake of the country, sake of the people, you would try to find some meeting of the minds for the betterment of people involved. But it's about them. It's like, we don't even exist. And so that's the danger, as far as I'm concerned, when you have people, these powers of power and privilege, these politicians, career politicians, they ain't going anywhere. They want to make sure that their pockets are lined and they'll be around for a while.
Yeah, and we'll be around right after this break with some more of the late-breaking stories of the week. Coming up, we'll talk about everything from white power to gay power to clean water. This is the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
Deeper. Remove the hype. Find the facts. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome back to it.
Boy, did we cover a lot in the first part of our show. If you missed it, that's really too bad. Actually, no, it isn't. You can find us online 24/7. Wherever you find podcasts, just look for the Shaggy Jenkins Show. Or you can find links off of our main website, shaggyjenkins.com. Of course, anytime that there's social media around, you can look at me at Shaggy Live. Of course, joining me today from the wonderful Free Nation of Chicago, or just about this close to doing it, please welcome the information headquarters himself, Chris Bass.
Thank you, Shaggy. Always good to be back. Always.
Ah, man. So we got to talk just a little bit about some bad news this week. And I begin with the story that we teased during the church fire story and the first segment. It's time to talk about the rise of white nationalists, Chris. First off, why aren't we talking more about the rise of white nationalists?
Well, the rise of white nationalism will have to be probably put into a separate category when it comes to broadcasting. It has to be a specialty type program because it's so deep in layers that it needs its own time. Now, it would be nice if it was in the regular mainstream. And depending on what kind of news stream you get, you might get that. But on a whole, you don't. Why? Because it's bad for business. And the reason why I say it's bad for business is because we also know that news, just like any other television program on cable or the like, is galvanized by money. So we got that. So I've always said the secret to certain programs like CNN, for example, everything on there, and I love CNN, one of my favorite sources, but everything is not breaking news. It should be just news, and you know, is breaking news so damn diluted, we don't know which is real breaking news or not. So here's the thing, my theory about that real quick. I've always said that breaking news was sponsored. So you just can't go in and say, breaking news, you know, brought to you by, you know, Acura. Bad form. So what you do probably is Acura sponsors the breaking news. And then when you, your first commercial break, it's an Acura commercial or something along those lines. So you format it differently. But it's to get some sort of attention. And it does. Breaking news. You know, you look at the TV screen, your eyes get all big and everything else. But it's like, oh, okay, that wasn't really that, you know, that big of a news deal. For example, the unfortunate tragic burning of Notre Dame, that's breaking news as far as I see. but we've used it so many times, it's everything. Breaking news. Man walks across the street and twists his ankle. Breaking news. He broke his ankle. So, again, you know, it's all diluted. And the whole thing about what we're seeing now when it comes to white power not having enough time on television is because, again, it's very uncomfortable to talk about. People at times don't want to bring it to the forefront, and it's also bad for business. So that's where your documentary is, and maybe a quick hit, a quote-unquote, when people are doing their news stories, special stories. Listen out to Terry Johnson. Talk about the violence going on in Tennessee. That Terry Johnson does like a four-minute thing, and then you move on. But as far as like more in-depth, more long-form, whole different story.
Yeah, and I mean, a part of me always has kind of been like, the reason that we don't have enough coverage of white power groups is because their prevalence has risen so much, and the diversity of media is so great that I'm afraid the report would start off with the reporter going, yeah, I'm down here in a trailer park in Mississippi to talk about white power. Oh my God, they're running towards us. Run, fellas. And the camera falls down. Like, I'm waiting for that kind of moment in a confrontation between media and white nationalists, because honestly, in 2016, we thought, whoa, this is the most white nationalist and white terrorist crimes that we have seen in over a decade. Then 2017 happened, and it was like, holy cow, they're marching with tiki torches now. 2018 came along, and it was like, oh, not only are they marching with tiki torches now, they're holding speeches at Berkeley. And now in 2019, we are at a point where white nationalism almost, despite the things that happened at the Highlander Civil Rights Center, a very historic place this month. I mean, they housed Rosa Parks. They housed Martin Luther King Jr. People like Mr. Peeler got their training there before they went on to states like Alabama and Mississippi during the height of the Civil Rights Movement. Irreplaceable documents of American history as far as the Civil Rights Movement were lost in a white nationalist suspected arson event this week. And with stories like this, Chris, why is it that somebody just don't get on the news, maybe a guy that resembles me, and sounds the alarm of, hey people, watch your crackers, they're going a little bit crackers?
Well, because first of all, the reporter has to get the nod from their boss to do said story. If the boss doesn't, you know, give them a yes or no, then you pick either one for them to go out and do the story and, you know, compile the information and put it all together for the masses to see. And at the same time, again, going back to the editor's desk, sometimes, you know, certain editors are like, well, look, you know, racists have money too. They're consumers too. We don't want to, you know, I hate to say it, we don't want to piss off a racist. So we'll just put it on the back burner for now. We'll make it come forward later, but probably not now. I'm just, once again, speculating. But it goes back to what is deemed important when you're doing news coverages. See, that's why people can joke about, say, NPR. You know, some people could be boring, but that's about the real news you're going to get as far as here in America without it being bastardized by money. So NPR, I always recommend NPR, and this show, obviously, because we're different. We come with the real. And that's the plug that is very, very shameless, but it's true. It's not filtered and not controlled. So when you're able for a lot of these people, when you see them on television, every single word they say is already documented. It's a speech. Why? Because they don't want to get sued, and legal has to be on point to make sure everything's protected. It's a brand. It's a business. So a lot of people are really news readers. The definition of news anchor has changed over the years. We did have people who were anchors who had some reporting experience. Nowadays, you get someone who knows how to read a teleprompter, read a script, look good in front of the camera, smile at the camera, you know, things like that, and able to become a quote-unquote news anchor. Those who do the reporting that have that acumen of a background of reporting, that's different. And not to knock anybody that has a job in that. I mean, I'm knocking anybody is going to get their cheddar. Go right ahead, get your money. But all I'm saying is that from where I sit at, the reconstruction of what broadcasting is and what it was, it literally two different worlds.
Yeah, because, I mean, we have literally ignored one of the scariest stories of modern times, which happens to deal with the son of a law enforcement officer out of the state of Louisiana being found, at least allegedly, of committing arson in three different historical black churches in his state and doing those for very racist reasons. That story barely even gets a blip. So, Chris, is it going to be kind of almost a blessing in disguise that the Iowa caucus this week also happened and Mayor Pete himself, who has been, by the way, eerily depicted in this weird GOP smear video online as wearing a paper sign with ink saying Mayor Pete trying to whip Jesus in somebody's driveway. Internet is weird, yo. But
yeah.
Mayor Pete did have kind of an encounter with white nationalists at the Iowa convention that he was holding. Essentially, he was there to announce his candidacy, which he rolled out earlier in the week, and to start caucusing because Iowa is one of the first big caucus states. Now, at two different occasions, Buttigieg was harassed and lambasted by anti-gay white guys. And one of them, I think his name was Terry something, he is actually a known leader of a white nationalist group who said that his attacks against Buttigieg were all about his proclamation of being gay, but still being religious. Now, Chris, have we really went off the deep cliff of sanity this week with white nationalists?
Of course we have, because white supremacy is insane. Anytime you think you're better than somebody else or you reign supreme over any other type of race, what an ego you must have to feel that you can, you know, just be that dominant, whether it's them, whether it's going to the background of, you know, Germany back in the day with Adolf Hitler, the master race, meaning, you know, tall and blue eyes and blonde hair. Well, I thought it was the damnedest thing because Adolf Hitler did not look like that. But Abel, he was still, you know, processing to people that that's what a German should look like. But look at you. You know, so again, it's the power of persuasion and getting people, getting a fervor to be excited, to buy into an ideal, and then take it from there. And the same with white supremacists. And I think with certain people, it's also obviously a psychological point of view, because if you feel that your life does not have a meaning to it, and you feel, you know, disenchanted and, you know, part of downtrodden, here comes someone tells you that, you know, you're better than anybody else, that regardless of what people say, your race is dominant. Let's show us some examples of how much our race meant something throughout the years, owning slaves and Germany and things like that. You come from a master race, and you should be more than what you are right now. And again, people buy into it, but they buy into it for the wrong reasons. There's nothing wrong with being race pride. We become race conscious to the point where you think your race is better than somebody else, then that's where you have issues at, especially from the standpoint of downgrading people of color, downgrading women, downgrading people who have gay, lesbian, you know, lifestyles. When you go against everybody and you think that your race is the dominant race of all time, that's where we have issues at.
Yeah, now keep in mind that Buttigieg has been having a kind of weird week as far as popularity, because not only did he get bashed at two separate events in Iowa, let's not forget that earlier on in the week, the Washington Post ran an op-ed piece that said Mayor Pete Buttigieg is not allowed to rewrite Christianity in his own image. But kind of one of these weird things, because I don't want to get into the religious angle of that whole story, but does it seem very odd to you that for a guy that is literally nothing more than a mayor of an Indiana town, the GOP and conservatives as a whole seem very threatened by just one facet of his life?
Of course, because, see, that is part of the GOP's, you know, playbook, is to go against everything from a Christian conservative perspective. Look at what 45 did. You know, he was running for the presidency. He was able to be embraced by Christianity from the standpoint of Christian conservatives to help galvanize his votes into the White House. And so when the conservative right, who buys into that from time to time, if not all the time, they're able to take that and say, look, you're going against the Bible, it's a sin, blah, blah, weed, everything else, because now you're all, not only are you an enemy because you're a Democrat, now you're an enemy because you're a Democrat and you're gay. So that's a double strike against you going against the conservative right. So that automatically becomes more of a fodder to go after. And again, you're placating to a conservative base of Christianity people who are conservative. So you need to put the line in the sand immediately to go after Mayor Pete in the situation of Buttigieg. So you're doing this because you had to fight two battles, liberals and gays and lesbians. So now here comes more of a battle, because if you didn't say anything, your base operation of people would question your motives.
You know, I mean, it pains me when you're right like this, so I'm just going to go ahead and give a, ouch, truth hurts. Truth hurts.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Systematically, Mayor Pete Buttigieg himself has been having a stellar kind of response to these people. Dare I say, Chris, it is very refreshing to have a gay man running for office so that we can see what throwing some shade and dropping a little tea is really like.
It is refreshing. And sometimes some certain local things could be a nuance to the future of national politics. Case in point, here in Chicago, we have Mayor-elect Lori Lightfoot, who is openly gay. And when she won the election, she openly kissed her partner, you know, in front of everybody. And so same with Buttigieg. So there was in fact, there was a poll about Buttigieg saying about 70% of people do not care about his sexual orientation. They want him to do the right thing by people as a politician. And see, that's where people should get it at. It's not what you do in the bedroom, but what you do outside in the room of public opinion and in that office of where you got elected at. That's the room. Not behind closed doors. That's your business. And people want to mix the two. Why? Because a lot of people, and I'll say this for the record, they're probably closet freaks in their own right and just don't come out and admit that. It's something wrong when you just go after somebody that strong. Well, you're going to hell, and you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. Well, maybe if you were able to check your own self before you riggedy wreck yourself, you may find out that maybe you like certain things, but you're mad that somebody else is placating that. See, it's always some sort of psychological thing going on, and a lot of people react to what they don't want to admit. That's them.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, to me, I kind of view life like Earn does from the show Atlanta, when he's sitting in the prison and old boy was hitting on this girl that wasn't really a girl. And he's like, yo, that's my ex-girlfriend. And they like, dude, you gay. And he's like, I ain't gay. I ain't gay. And he looks at Earn, and Earn just like, sexuality is a spectrum. You can truly do what you ever, whatever you want to do. Like, he is trying to stay out. Out of
you know,
it.
I've not seen that show, but someone sent me that clip. Man, I hollered. It was hilarious.
Because it's true. And this is the thing that really gets me when it comes to the Midwest. Finally, they are going to get their absolute wet dream. There is nothing but white men in the White House. This is literally the conservative perfect vision. Why is it then they are so desperate to go ahead and keep in mind, in a field that contains both Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, and Bernie Sanders and more, Buttigieg is not really that big of a draw compared to the Sanders and Harris factor. But the thing is, Chris, they have went with him with laser-like focus over his lifestyle right out of the gate. And I just, for the life of me, can't figure out what is the biggest threat about a guy that right now, let's just be honest, and is in a very crowded field of contenders that nobody knows what's going to happen next from.
But I think Shaggy Buttigieg's star will rise, only because of the fact that he'll have tremendous backing. And we've all seen in any type of situation when it comes to the gay and lesbian community that they do back their own. I mean, they come in droves as support. So you got to give them credit where credit is due at. And then plus, they have a great They have a great war chest when it comes to money backing up whoever. And so in this situation, you'll see his popularity rise. And we'll start seeing the debates come through when people are able to take away the fact that he's gay. Take it out of the equation. Mm-hmm. Listen to him as a politician. Listen to him as the message that he's trying to give to the American people. When you get past that sideshow and listen intensely to what he has to say, he could be a game changer. I really believe that.
Oh, yeah. I do, too, because the thing is a lot of the stuff that he's talking about is very centrist, not far left, not liberal, right. Liberal, very centrist principles from a DNC candidate. And that's refreshing to see after so many years of far one side or the other of the spectrum. But here's the thing. And I mean, maybe this is just me coming from Hawaii, where, you know, when we talk about gay people, we have really, really, really specific stereotypes here. One of them is, of course, if you know somebody and you're very comfortable with them, you call them Mary. That's just their name. Mary, stop, you know? But two, this is the thing that we don't get. And I mean this from a state, like I said, very open about our acceptance of LGBTQ people. When we from Hawaii look at this story on a national scale, we're going, it's not like Mayor Pete is noticeably gay. If you ran into this guy in a grocery store, you would never know. And I mean, even one of my friends brought up the point. They expect him almost to start every sentence with the word girl and end with a mouth pop. Am I wrong here?
Yeah. No, you're right, because he's not playing to the stereotype. Same with President Barack Obama when he was in office. They thought that he would be, you know, thuggish, ruggish bone, or wave him to trip up and show his quote-unquote black card. And he never did. And that roused the right, because, see, now you start manufacturing things to go against the quote-unquote enemy between the right to the left and vice versa. But in this situation, the right to the left. And this situation with Buttigieg, who I'm telling you, mark my word, I don't go on a limb with too many people, but I believe that he's going to ascend in the names of a Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris, because his message will galvanize him through. And the LGBTQ community will have that war chest for him to continue on his quest for the presidency, and it will be just fine. But what happens is when you're the conservative right and you buy into stereotypes, because that's what they deal in, stereotypes, and that person is not acting that way, then you have to go back and to the lab and refine something else to go after the person with. Because you already destroyed the first stereotype. He's not taking his fist or, you know, fingers are snapping, and he's not saying girl things like that. He's not sipping on tea, whatever. And that does not bode well. So what you got to do now, you got to go manufacture something to go after him with, because that's how the Republicans deal.
Yeah, and this is the thing, because we're going to run out of time if we're not careful. Buttigieg has been on record time and time again about the federal government's slow response to crises across the United States, specifically crises that have affected places like Flint, Michigan. Now, we have known about the problem with Flint, Michigan's water supply for ages. Just this week, after everything that has been said and done in all the media way back, like almost 2 years ago now, just this week, Chris, they finally got federal funding to help fix their water system. Thoughts?
It could have been sooner, obviously, you know, but again, it goes back to the same theory that I talked about earlier in the conversation, Shaggy, about the whole thing with editing the media. What is important? What sets precedence over one or the other when it comes to a case-by-case basis? You would think that a water crisis in Flint, Michigan should be top priority. But if it's not in the eyes of a certain governmental style, then it does. It takes a back seat. While people are suffering, while people have to try to find water to survive, is a known fact that we need water just to, you know, intake and on a consistent basis. We know we need water to drink and survive with. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that it's vitally important. We have people individually sending water, bottles of water, in droves to Flint, Michigan to help out, but it should have been top priority. I guess better late than never, but we should have got to this point in the first place.
Yeah, we should have got to this point, I don't know, maybe a couple of brain-damaged kids ago.
Yeah.
But this is the thing, because there is sad, sad stories, and then there is Michigan. And Flint, Michigan has been a problem that a lot of people have ignored for the longest time. And the fact that they just now got federal funding, after all is said and done, is it going to be any surprise to us that the funding isn't actually enough to fix the total problem?
It's not, but you got to start from somewhere. Because now, you know, you're just trying to put a Band-Aid on a really gushing blood situation. So you can't just put a Band-Aid on a wound, you got to go in and repair the wound, fix the wound, but to be completely healed. So Flint, Michigan has a long way to go before it has healing processes.
Yeah, and I mean, just to give to some kind of context to this story, look, a kind of poll of engineers across the United States was recently conducted and specifically dealt with infrastructure problems, bridges, waterways, and roadway systems. And if we were to start a massive effort to repair our country, they are predicting it would take some 84 years if we started tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's sad. I mean, and that makes sense. Why? Because a lot of cities and highways and byways, or depending where you live at, once again, go back similar to what we talked about with the Notre Dame Cathedral being 850 years old. A lot of these constructions, a lot of these, say, in pipes, were created, you know, what, in the 1920s or probably earlier than that. So you got to figure, how do you keep maintenance with that? You probably have to restructure the whole thing just to get up to date. You know, whether it's copper or whether it's other types of sources that they used for it, you got to probably dig up all over again and then start from scratch just to make sure the next 80-something years won't be as traumatic. So it's a process that's going to be around for a while, but you got to start somewhere. Give them the money, give them the fundage to start right now.
Yeah, because as long as we're talking about ending things and getting some fundage, we're going to end on a good note here. I've got about... Oh, shoot! We're out of time! Look, okay. I just want to say this. Doc Rivers is the luckiest man alive. Look it up.
Yeah. Take a look at it.
Yeah. Chris, thanks for joining the show again.
Thank you as always, my brother. Looking forward to it next week.
Yeah. For everybody, check me out online, ShaggyJenkins.com. Until next time, love you, mean it. Kaden, bye.